Good morning. I'd like to call House Special Committee on Fisheries meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, March 14th, and let the record reflect it's 10:01 a.m. Today we have President Representative Johnson, Representative Stutes, Representative McCabe, and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Justin Hayes with House Records and Lisa Denny with the Juno LAO. On today's agenda, the committee will take up House Bill 92, Fisherman's Fund, in its second hearing by the House Special Committee on Fisheries. And the second order of business is that we will receive presentations on hatcheries by the Alaska Salmon Hatchery Alliance and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So we will now take a brief at ease.
Thank you.
Back on record, we will now take up House Bill 92, Fisherman's Fund. Members should have received a new committee substitute for this bill that will raise the reimbursement amount to $15,000 for vessel owners and crew members. I will now entertain a motion from Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the committee adopt the new CS for HB 92 version 33-LS0520/B. As its new working document.
And I will object for purposes of discussion.
So I guess I'll bite.
Representative McCabe, would you speak to the changes of the CS?
Sure. So this CS just changes it started at 5, I think, right? And then we were going to change it to 10, and now that we've bumped it up to 15, I don't think in this current age, it hasn't moved for years, so I think 15 is probably more appropriate. And that's it. So it's page 1, line 10, 15,000 instead of 10, line 12, 15,000 instead of 10. And page 2, line 6, 15,000 instead of 5.
I would like to let the record reflect by Representative Carpenter, Representative McCormick, Representative Hemshute. We have a full committee. Yes, the changes in the CS increase the claim by the vessel owner and the crew member to 15,000. And I have also asked for a graph from the department asking for the changes to the fund on this amended change. So I would ask if our two folks would join us from the fund administrator, Velma Thomas, and Charles Collins, Director of Department of Labor. If you would please state your name for the record. Thank you for being available. If you would speak to this proposed change and the impacts to the Fisherman's Fund.
To the Chair, thank you.
Thank you again for inviting us to come and speak. According to the graph, it is based on average, a 9-year average of what we've seen in the fund's history. And the yellow here, I guess, is that showing red there? is with the 15,000 with I believe it's the worst case scenario. And of course, this is all subject to what we've experienced. I'm not certain if there is concern moving it to 15,000, but it, we have had 3 years of COVID, which I think was a direct effect on probably the number of claims we've received. So hopefully this, like I said, it's just a projection. Does it increase the risk of possibly that the fund would spin down more? Unknown.
Charles Collins, Director of Workers' Compensation. So what Velma is kindly saying that, you know, as all financial managers would tell you, the past performance is not indicative of future growth or loss. So this is our forecast as we go forward. The department has no opinion either way. The council had wanted to raise the vessel owner reimbursement to 10,000, the crew member reimbursement, the crew member coverage for medical and transportation costs was already capped at 10,000. We had done that, we think, in 2010. We're not positive off the top of our heads without going back and looking. And so we do have some look back on the crew member side. The number of claims have fallen the last couple of years, but there's been less activity on the in the fleet also. Other than that, the department is agnostic on this.
Representative Hinshu.
Thank you. Through the chair, my question is about the look back. And, you know, during COVID, there might have been less effort, so less opportunity for injury and that kind of thing. Looking back, is there an average number of claims per year since the fund's been around since 51? It seems like, I know it doesn't predict the future, but it would be helpful to know, I guess your projection here includes that look back. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Through the chair to Representative Hinshaw, I did see that in 2010 when the council raised the limits to 10, that there was this concern. But then again, a couple of years later, there was the Affordable Health Care Act. Now, this is just my observations. There's no science behind it, but there did appear to be a correlation that helped with the decrease in claims. It's just an observation that over those years where folks were required to have personal insurance, we saw the decline decrease. So now if that changes, it could change the environment of, you know, funds available to help injured fishermen. Now, and that could be an opposite effect, you know, going forward.
Follow up?
I guess my question might be for the chair, maybe. Is it easy then in the future, if there's a problem where we're dropping too low, is it an easy fix legislatively to reduce it back to 10,000? Would that be the remedy if somehow we got ourselves in trouble with this?
Representative Hinshu, it is a statutory change. I know that it was a few years ago that they had moved the claim from 2,500 to 5,000, and because the higher cost of health care and the premiums, they have the request to raise it to 10. But looking at the purpose of the fund is for the fishermen. We wanted to entertain the idea of raising the limit to 15,000 because the cost and the premiums have increased. And as long as the fund remains stable in the future, we wanted to entertain the idea of being proactive in raising to 15,000, not only for vessel owners, but crew members as well.
One follow-up. When was the last time it was changed, the 2,500 to the 5,000?
That's the vessel owner, and I believe that occurred in 2019. 2019. I think it was 2018.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. I feel a little trepidous about the additional $5,000 at this point, particularly taking in view or into consideration the fact that, as was explained, there weren't that many claims because of the COVID and the lack of participation, I guess. I don't have any problems raising it to 10,000, but I'd rather see the fund remain static and know that it's going to be static and be there to help than it would be to destabilize it by increasing it by too much, I think. It's a tough one, but it does make me a little bit uncomfortable. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Ms. Thomas, with that in mind, and with the chart looking at the future projections based on the 9-year average, in the yellow, it shows that with the 15,000, that the health of the fund remains stable, doesn't dip down. But is the 9-year average, how far of a look back to be able to create that average? Because we had the last few years with COVID, but what is that historical average number of claims that helps you make this projection?
That's a good question to the chair. I would say that was claim activity of about 300 claims a year, whereas back before 2014, the claims were smaller, but there were a lot more. They were probably averaging 400 to 600 claims. But then again, they didn't have a bigger pot of money to pay bills. So I don't think I could really compare apples and oranges just because of the changes that were happening. And like this is just a best guess of, you know, the last 9 years of the projections of the possibilities at the current claim levels. So I guess that would be the next big question, if the claim activity stayed the same.
So to answer Representative Hemshute's question of, if we were to increase this to 15,000, because by all projections the fund appears stable, mm-hmm. and the amount of claims, it appears that it would be helpful to our fishermen. If in a few years that 15,000 seemed to be too high, what would be the impact on the fishermen be if we were to statutorily go back and try to reduce that number?
I'm not sure if I can answer that. I don't know, to the chair, sorry, because then that would take the council going before and presenting information. I just don't know how quickly that can be done. But
through the chair, if I might say, we watch the Fish Fund extremely carefully because of the nature of that fund. You know, being set up in 1951, pre-statehood, the fund draws quite a bit of attention from not only the department, but the council and the participants in the fund. So I would lay out a scenario where if we felt that it was being impacted, more than likely the director would be visiting often and begging to have something done rapidly, as the pressure would probably be felt in my office if we were impacting this fund. This is a one-of-a-kind fund in the state of Alaska. We take our job of being the actuarials for the fund extremely serious. As Velma has pointed out, we've dropped claims by, you know, maybe a fifth, you know, maybe 20%, you know, in that area over the years. We don't know how much of that might be on COVID. There's also, you know, comparatively speaking to 20 years ago, there's less participants in the fishery. The claims have changed in nature also from being, you know, smaller, just like everything else. You know, medical attention and transportation has continued to rise in expense. And this was the impetus for both the reimbursement for the crew members a few years back, and now for the vessel owners, as insurance costs have also increased in price. The council was extremely comfortable with going to 10,000 with the vessel owners and keeping the crew member the same. We don't have any feedback as of yet with them of increasing both to 15,000. But Velma's projections, I will speak from watching her work for many years and say that she is careful. So probably not a, you know, not a major impact. Probably will level out the growth of the fund, though. But it only takes one bad claim. So,
Representative Hemshi.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
Hey, through the chair. Do we get an annual update on this fund, or is this, you're here because of the change that we're making, or is there an annual update on the health of the fund?
Through the chair, there is no, under statute, there is no, the only updates we do on the fund as far are through to the council. The legislature occasionally will get a call asking about the health of the fund or just some background on it, but there isn't anything in statute that requires us to turn in an annual report such as some other funds in the state.
Mm-hmm. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So after the last meeting that we had, I had a conversation with some fishermen and just asked the question, would it benefit fishermen now to have a higher amount that can be reimbursed from the fishermen's fund? And would they be interested in seeing that happen? If the fund could be maintained, it didn't have a negative impact on the fund. And the answer that I received was, yes, that would be beneficial to fishermen. As I'm looking at the chart here, I see a fund balance in 2024 projected at approximately $13.3 million. And the projection for 2033, all things else staying the same, of somewhere around $13.8 million. So under no circumstances are we projecting that the fund balance is in jeopardy. Quite the opposite. It continues to grow. It just doesn't grow at the same rate as, or to the same level at which the other options that are presented to us on the chart are. And so the question in my mind is one that is weighed to the value of the current generation versus the future generation. And the question is, how much money does the Fisherman Fund need to have? And if we continue to grow it at a rate that's presented with a 5,000 payment or the 10,000 payment, what happens when you get to a very large fund balance that it becomes a bigger target for other bigger fish in the ocean, if you will? And so if you're able to balance the needs of the current generation with the needs of the future generation with a higher draw now, but it keeps the fund balance at a level where we think is going to benefit the future generation, but reduce the risk that the balance becomes a target, then that seems to be a prudent thing to do, especially when we have high cost of insurance, high cost of health care coverage going up. And so that is why I went down this road. Under no circumstances do I want to put the fund's balance in jeopardy. And I don't think the fishermen want that. And that's not what's being communicated to me, that going this route is likely to put the fund in jeopardy. Thank you.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In listening to the conversation, I certainly would rather see the fishermen get these funds than I would, as you suggested, Representative Carpenter, have it be a target for bigger fish. I think that's really, really critical in this situation. And as was stated earlier, that if you see the fund becoming a little bit too volatile, then you would immediately, I would presume, contact the legislature and let them know that. So I definitely can support it under those conditions.
Any further questions by committee members? Representative McCabe, do you maintain? Oh wait, it was my objection. I remove my objection to adopting the committee substitute. Is there further objection? Hearing none, the CS for House Bill 92 has now been adopted as our new working document. I will now open public testimony for House Bill 92. Is there anyone in the room that would like to... thank you so much. My apologies. Thank you, Mr. Collins and Ms. Thomas, for speaking to the fund and the work that you do to maintain the health of the fund. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 92? Please state your name for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jerry McHugh, and I represent Cordova District Fishermen United. And I think these changes are good. I mean, we changed it from 5 to 10. In fact, then the medical costs were pretty high for the fishermen. So you don't know in a particular year how many injuries you're going to have, but I think the fund could sustain it, and I think both moves are very good, and we support that, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Any further testifiers in the room? Seeing none, I don't believe we have any online.
Brief at ease, Madam
Chair. Brief at ease. Back on record, seeing that there's no one online or in the LAOs for public testimony, I will now close public testimony on House Bill 92. House Bill 92 is amended before us. Do members have any final comments before we entertain a motion to move this bill? Wonderful. I will now look to the will of the committee in moving out House Bill 92 as amended. Representative McCabe, may I have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House Special Committee on Fisheries move HB 92 as amended, version 33-LS0520/B, from committee and give alleged legal permission to make all needed technical and conforming changes.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 92 has passed, and we will take a brief at ease to sign the report. Back on record. We will now hear a presentation on Alaska hatcheries by the Alaska Salmon Hatchery Alliance. Presenting in the room today is Mr. Mike Wells, the Executive Director for the Valdez Fisheries Development Association, and Mr. Scott Wagner, the General Manager for the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. Thank you both for coming to the Capitol for this presentation. If you could please join us at the table. State your name for the record and begin your presentation. I believe committee members should have all of the documents and be able to follow along with the slideshow.
Okay.
For the record, Scott Wagner, General Manager, NSRA, based out of Sitka.
For the record, Mike Wells, Valdez Fisheries Development Association Executive Director. So thank you, Chairman Vance and members of the House Fisheries for the opportunity to address you here today. Today I would like to talk with you briefly about the history of Alaska's hatchery programs, regional hatchery production, and economic impacts these vitally important entities make to the state. Alaska's hatcheries are truly unique. Alaska has 8 private nonprofit aquaculture associations, or
PNPs, as we call them, 9 if we include the Sitka Sound Science Center. While our presentation speaks to all of Alaska's PNP hatchery associations, only some of these associations are part of the Alaska Salmon Aquaculture Alliance, which works to increase the legislature's understanding of our hatchery programs and the contributions made to Alaska's fisheries, communities, and economies. Together, Alaska's PNP operators operate 26 hatchery facilities, 11 of which are state facilities operated under contractual agreements to these associations. Collectively, we conduct fisheries enhancement programs for all 5 species of Pacific salmon, from Ketchikan to Juneau, Prince William Sound to Cook Inlet, and Kodiak. Alaska's PNP hatchery programs were established as a response to depressed wild salmon returns across the state in the early 1970s. These organizations have been a key factor in bringing forth a recovery of Alaska's salmon fisheries over the last 50 years. Shortly after statehood in 1959, Alaska began to manage its fisheries resources within and around our state waters. In 1973, Alaska voters approved the Limited Entry Act, and also around this time, the state formed the Fisheries Rehabilitation Enhancement Development, or FRED, division within the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. These 2 steps provided for limitation of commercial fisheries participants and construction of state hatcheries and various rehabilitation projects to improve overall salmon abundance. In 1974, the legislature approved the Private Nonprofit Hatchery Act. This legislation created regulatory structure for PNPs to build and operate hatcheries in Alaska's coastal regions. Further legislation established methods to recover costs to fund the operations of these new programs through the collection of enhancement taxes and fish sales, and to enable the ability for PNPs to retire capital loans authorized through the state's Fisheries Enhancement Revolving Loan Fund program. When state budgetary contractions and fiscal challenges ensued in coming years, PNP associations assumed the operations of many of the state's hatcheries and rehabilitation efforts previously conducted by the FRED division. Today, Alaska's hatchery program is nearing 50 years since its inception, and we continue to see sustainable salmon productivity as further example of the original intent and mission set forth by the state of Alaska many years ago. Each of Alaska's hatchery associations are dedicated to the core mission of sustainably increasing salmon abundance and enhancing sport, commercial, subsistence, and personal use fisheries while protecting wild stocks. Alaska's hatchery programs, by design, exist to supplement natural production, not replace or displace it. This slide shows a great example of that premise. Recorded statewide salmon harvest for all species beginning in 1900 through 1975 shows a long period of low abundance and decline of natural salmon stocks, which averaged around 40 million wild salmon harvest annually. With the advent of hatcheries in the late 1970s, harvest of salmon stock steadily increased to an average of 75 million wild salmon annually. And over the last 10 years, while hatchery production statewide has generally remained stable for all species, including pink and chum salmon, harvest of wild Alaskan salmon has increased even further to an average annual harvest of approximately 184 million. Natural salmon production comprises about 131 million of the total for that time period, and this is an increase of 338% from the 10 years of wild production before the hatchery contributions began, 1967 through 1976. Through the benefits of favorable marine conditions, sound salmon management policies, and enhancement, it is evident that overall, harvests of both wild and enhanced salmon have generally improved over the last 50 years, greatly stabilizing Alaska's salmon industry. This slide shows the percentage of each species produced by hatcheries statewide for the past year. Alaska hatcheries raise all 5 species of salmon, of Pacific salmon, although the majority of hatchery production comes from pink and chum salmon. The reason pink and chum salmon are selected for propagation is twofold. The first being that a short hatchery resident time and consistent hymerene survivals for pinks and chums provides a stable base for hatchery association budgets. This fiscal stability not only funds the production of salmon for commercial fisheries, but it also funds many of the programs enjoyed by sport, subsistence, and personal users. The second being the long-established regional fisheries for which these two species of programs were preliminarily planned to benefit.
Mr. Wells, we have a question from Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. Through the chair, I am curious about the pink salmon count and such a high number of pink salmon, which are sort of thought to be the less valuable fish when compared with the coho, chinook, and sockeye. So wouldn't introducing so many pink salmon into the habitat decrease the food for the more highly valuable and highly sought after fish? In other words, if we put a whole bunch of pinks into the habitat, don't they compete for the same food source, or am I wrong in thinking that?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that's a good question, and it's certainly a question that the fishery scientists with the state have been reviewing and looking at, even all the way back to the beginning of the hatchery programs. What I would say is that we've had very stable pink salmon production, and in that time period we've seen increases in pink salmon harvests and declines, as well as other fisheries or other species. I think that what the science would probably show, or what line of thought would be, is that pink salmon, just like any other salmon, is subjective to its environment, not necessarily controlling it. So I don't know that that's a question that we as hatchery operators are going to be able to answer. It's a much broader, vast open ocean environment that I think is going to take a lot of research and work. So I'm not sure if I can answer your question.
Follow up.
Thank you. So yeah, I'm particularly concerned because Commissioner Vincent Lang and others from the state are saying that the failure or some contribution to the failure of kings and chum, especially on the Upper Yukon, can be laid directly at the door of Russian and Asian hatchery fish, the billions, and I think I read an article that said maybe 2.1 billion pinks are released from Russia, Asia, into our habitat, into our environment, and they're sort of saying, in addition to some global warming and some acidification, which causes less food or less feed for the fish, they're saying that our failures in our fisheries, especially the fisheries that are directly affecting the villages on the Upper Yukon to the point where they don't have a fishery anymore, can be laid at least in part at the hatcheries fish coming from Russia, Asia. And I assume since Alaska actually puts out more hatchery fish than Russia does, that our fish could be part of that problem.
Go ahead.
Well, through the chair, Mr. McCabe.
State your name for the record.
Scott Wagner for the record. So Bill Templin's online. He can answer some of these questions. The state is looking into this issue. I mean, there's a task force being formed to look into additional research that's needed in the ocean. But I will say that for the past 40 years, the total hatchery production put into the North Pacific has remained virtually stable. So the numbers have not increased in the last 40 years, and something has changed maybe in the Gulf, but the numbers of hatchery fish has not increased.
Follow up.
You mean from Alaska?
Mm-hmm. No.
Or are you saying total?
Internationally.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this remains stable, about $5
billion. And I think you may have stepped out of the room while I announced that after the Hatchery Alliance presentation, we are going to have Fish and Game be able to talk to some of the science. And then on Thursday, we will have Dr. Katie Howard here to discuss the research that she has conducted that can also address this overarching question that so many people have. But the answers that you just presented about the hatchery fish in our region remaining stable, could you state that again and then continue on your presentation? Because that's something that I think is very pertinent to the conversation.
Yeah. Madam Chair, hatchery production in Alaska for pinks and chums has remained relatively stable since the 1990s. The programs are what I would say are fully mature. There's not been a lot of opportunity or requests to grow these programs. I'm not sure if I stated exactly what you were looking for, but yeah, that's the reason why they're so stable is because the capacity, I believe, of the hatchery program is maximized.
Thank you. Please continue.
Subsistence and personal use comprise most of the non-commercial harvest of hatchery-produced sockeye salmon. Sport, personal use, and subsistence harvest of hatchery origin salmon in 2022 was estimated at 168,000 fish, with coho salmon being the largest contributor, followed by sockeye and chinook. The PNP hatchery programs truly represent one of the most successful and consistent public-private partnerships in the state's history. These facilities, whether state or privately owned, produce salmon for the common property, which includes sport, subsistence, personal use, and commercial fisheries at no cost to the state. The program is entirely self-funded through cost recovery of returning adult salmon, as well as the self-assessed salmon enhancement tax that salmon permit holders levied on themselves in each region with an active aquaculture association. The revenues generated through commercial harvests, landings, and fish taxes go back to the communities and into state coffers and represent a great return on the state's initial investment in these programs. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commercial Fisheries Division provides for oversight and permitting of hatcheries under AS 1610 and 5 AAC 40. Before approval, hatchery permits are subject to rigorous review by ADF&G for compatibility with existing salmon management and the state's genetics, pathology, and sustainable fisheries policies to minimize the impacts to natural stocks. Changes to hatchery production, when requested to increase or decrease production, or for selection of species, are subjected to the same evaluation process before approval. All aspects of hatchery operations are monitored and reported to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game annually. These include disease, egg take numbers and survivals, release of juvenile salmon, and monitoring of adult returns for broodstock collection. The cost recovery and common property harvests, wastewater discharge, and compliance with other regulatory permitting are reported as required. In addition to hatchery management plans for production of hatchery salmon are reviewed and approved annually, and opportunities for public input on production and programs are made available. Some examples include publicly noticed regional planning team meetings in each region that hatcheries are located in, diverse public representation on aquaculture association boards, and Board of Fisheries hatchery committee meetings held annually, with the exception of this year. So this slide shows the releases and gives an indication of the overall, the varying overall production of juveniles for each of the four associations within the South Central region. The percentage of released juvenile salmon is shown in comparison to the overall permitted capacity. Program production and species produced vary from region to region and hatchery to hatchery. Reasons that numbers of juveniles released are generally lower than permitted egg take goals can be a result of reduced in-resident survival, or less than permitted ATAKE goals being achieved. Combined, South Central Hatchery Associations released just under 1.2 million juveniles of all species in 2022. 83% of that is estimated to be pink salmon, 14% chums, 3% sockeye, and the remainder coho and chinook.
Before you move on from this slide on the hatchery production, in our personal conversations, I asked you how much is that? How many of our fry make it? And you know, what's the percentage of the harvest that you see fry mortality? I'm not sure what the term is. Could you speak to that real quick before you move on? Because I think that was a shocking number to me.
Well, I'll take an example of the Solomon Gulch hatchery in Valdez, which is I'm most familiar with because I oversee that. We're permitted to take 270 million pink salmon eggs. That's our egg take goal. If we achieve that, we can expect about 95% survival from egg take to release. So that is about 250 million juvenile fry that are released from our hatchery. The number of fish that come back is what we call the marine survival. And for that facility, it averages most years around 6%. So that will yield a adult return of somewhere around 15 to 16 million. So that means that on average, about 95% of those fry do not survive to adult. So they're either consumed in the ocean as feed for other animals, or they succumb to some other natural condition, and they do not make it. So a large number of fry overall for all hatchery programs are subjected to the variabilities of the natural environment and do not return as adults.
All right, thank you. Please continue.
Alaska's hatchery programs are significant economic engines for the commercial fishing, seafood processing, and tourism industries. Based on the most recent 2018 McDowell report titled Economic Impacts of Alaska Salmon Hatcheries, the total economic impact of all PNP hatchery programs generated approximately $600 million in annual income, annual economic output, and provided for an estimated 4,700 jobs. For the South Central region, during this period, fisheries enhancement programs generated an economic impact of $365 million in annual economic output, creating 2,700 jobs, an average of $76 million in ex-vessel value, and $125 million in annual labor income. I'd like to just briefly now touch on the individual hatchery associations within the South Central region. The Valdez Fisheries Development Association operates the Solomon Gulch Hatchery, which produces pink and coho salmon for the common property fisheries of Prince William Sound. Solomon Gulch is currently the largest single pink salmon facility in the state and is unique in that it utilizes an early pink salmon stock for production. VFDA pink salmon returns provide early season harvest opportunity for the Prince William Sound purse seine fleet, and for the last decade, it contributed approximately 16.5 million fish annually to the common property fisheries of Prince William Sound, or approximately 33% of the seine harvest for the region overall. VFDA's contributions are not limited to pink salmon. VFDA coho salmon generates an average annual return of about 80,000 adult coho salmon, which represents more than 80% of the sport-caught coho harvest within the Valdez Arm, a resource that is utilized by salmon harvesters from Prince William Sound to the Mat-Su to Fairbanks and to other parts of the interior. VFDA also provides coho smolt release to the native village of Tetitlik for subsistence harvest opportunity. The Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation is based out of Cordova with logistics facilities in Anchorage. PISWAC operates five hatcheries, three of which are owned by the state. Four of these facilities are located within Prince William Sound, while a fifth is located on the Gulkana River. The Main Bay and Gulkana hatcheries focus on sockeye production. while the Walter Nuremberg, Cannery Creek, and Armin F. Corning hatcheries produce primarily pink chum and coho salmon. Recent studies showed an average 70% of Pislax production goes to the common property fisheries of the Copper River and Prince William Sound, contributing more than 539 million pounds of salmon and average common property harvest value of $49 million. Coho stocking projects contribute over 16,000 fish annually to sport fishing harvests in the communities of Cordova, Whittier, and Chenega. Chenega also receives stocked Chinook salmon through the cooperative agreement with ADF&G. An evaluation in 2018 showed that over 30% of the chitina dipnet harvest on the Copper River was provided by fish returning to the Gulcana hatchery, which also contributed approximately 25% of the famed Copper River Red Run during that time. Salmon harvesters of all user groups that benefit from Pislax hatchery projects represent residents from across the state, including Anchorage, Matsu, Fairbanks, Valdez, and Cordova. The Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association covers the Kenai Peninsula and waters of Cook Inlet, stretching up into Matanuska and the Susitna River drainage and western and lower portions of Cook Inlet. KIAA is headquartered in Kenai and currently operates three hatcheries at Trail Lakes near Seward, Tutka Bay Lagoon, and Port Graham, producing pink, sockeye, and coho salmon. Cook Inlet Aquaculture operates three hatcheries, two of which are owned by the state and operated under professional service agreements. KIAA's projects contribute to many sport, personal use, and subsistence fisheries, providing the only resource of coho and sockeye salmon for those fisheries in Resurrection Bay. In recent times, Cook Inlet Aquaculture has produced more than 26,000 sockeyes annually for sport anglers to harvest. Cook Inlet Aquaculture also has an active research and evaluation division, which dedicates time for habitat surveys, flow controls, beaver dams, as well as analysis of smolt and adult enumeration projects and evaluation. Cook Inlet Aquaculture has long been involved in the evaluation and eradication efforts of invasive species on the Kenai Peninsula and other areas of their region. And finally, in the Kodiak region, we have the Kodiak Regional Aquaculture Association, which was formed in 1983 and operates two state-owned hatcheries and produces all five species of Pacific salmon. KRAA produces large numbers of sockeye and coho that support subsistence and sport fisheries around Kodiak Island and partners with ADF&G to provide opportunity for Chinook rainbow trout fishing on the Kodiak Road system. KRAA supports significant research and monitoring efforts to increase understanding of area salmon stocks. In 2022, KRAA estimated a contribution of over 4 million adult salmon with an estimated ex-vessel value of over $5 million. This equated to around 20% of the pink salmon harvest, just under 10% of the projected sockeye salmon harvest for the Kodiak management area last year. And finally, KRAA suspended sockeye cost recovery harvests in 2020 and pink salmon cost recovery operations in 2018 to put as many fish as possible into fishermen's nets, ultimately contributing to over half of the pink salmon harvest for Kodiak that year. And with that, Madam Chair, that concludes the South Central portion, and I'll turn it over to Scott Wagner to talk about Southeast Alaska.
All right. Good morning. For the record, my name is Scott Wagner, and I'll review the Southeast hatchery production and programs. In the Southeast Alaska region, there are two regional associations and three non-regional private nonprofit hatcheries and one federal research hatchery. The region stretches from Haines Skagway to Dixon Interest on the southern end. I'm the general manager for the Sitka-based Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. Based out of Ketchikan, you have the Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, SARA. And then the next three hatchery associations are non-regional, private nonprofit organizations. As required in state statute, salmon hatcheries in Alaska must be private nonprofit. Right here in Juneau is the Douglas Island Pink and Chum Hatchery, more commonly known as DIPAC, and located near the southern tip of Baranoff Island is Armstrong Keita Hatchery. Also in Sitka is the Sitka Sound Science Center Hatchery, previously known as the Sheldon Jackson Hatchery, and my alma mater, where I was first introduced to salmon hatcheries 30 years ago. Lastly, there is a small federal hatchery, Little Port Walter, located on East Baranoff Island, based out of the Auk Bay Laboratory, as their primary field research facility for salmon and other species.
In contrast to the South Central region, the primary species of production in Southeast is chum salmon. Similar to pink production in the South Central region, the production of chum salmon allows for sufficient revenue to help offset costs of rearing and releasing the more costly produced coho, sockeye, and chinook salmon, which requires significant investment of time and water resources compared to chum salmon. Also unique to the Southeast region is the additional complexities of production and harvest management in relation to the Pacific Salmon Treaty. A significant portion of the sockeye, coho, and chinook production in Southeast is to meet treaty objectives or to offset treaty quota loss to historical harvest in the Southeast common property fisheries, including sport fishing, as a result of treaty agreements. For the Southeast region, fisheries enhancement programs produce an annual economic output of roughly $237 million, creating roughly 2,000 jobs and $44 million in vessel value, and a $90 million in annual labor income. And I'll now briefly review the associations and hatcheries in the Southeast region. My organization, INSRA, is headquartered in Sitka, and region stretches from Haines to the north and south to Petersburg. We operate four hatcheries and multiple remote release sites. We have two hatcheries in Sitka. Our Bear Cove facility is our primary Chinook hatchery, and our Sawmill Cove facility is our primary Sitka-based Cove facility. We are also currently expanding our Sawmill Cove facility, utilizing Pacific Salmon Treaty mitigation funds to increase Chinook production to help offset the 7.5% quota loss on Chinook salmon from the last renegotiation of the treaty. We operate one state-owned facility at Hidden Falls on the east side of Baranoff Island, which is our largest facility and produces a majority of our chum and coho production. We also operate a hatchery in the community of Cake on Kupernoff Island, which produces chum salmon and has a small release of Chinook for local sport fishing opportunity. INSRA partners with the Sitka Sound Science Center hatchery on releases of chum and Chinook salmon in the Sitka area. And we are also partnering with NOAA and the Auk Bay Laboratory at their Little Fort Walter Research Facility on a Chinook salmon broodstock development program and complementary research on rearing strategy to boost Alaskan hatchery Chinook production and survival. Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, initially formed in 1976, one of the older associations, is a regional association for the area from Petersburg to Ketchikan. They operate hatcheries in the communities of Ketchikan, Klawak, Craig, Petersburg, and additionally they have hatcheries in Neese Bay and Burnett Inlet outside of Ketchikan. In Ketchikan, they operate two hatcheries, the Deer Mountain Hatchery producing Chinook, coho, and rainbow trout as a local sport fishing program. The second Ketchikan hatchery is Whitman Lake producing chum, chinook, and coho salmon. On Prince of Wales Island, they also operate two hatcheries, one in the community of Klawak on the Klawak River producing 4 million coho annually. This facility was originally constructed by the State Fred Division and now currently operated by SARA. Also on Prince of Wales Island outside the community of Craig is a Port St. Nick hatchery producing chinook salmon for local release as well as chum salmon for the release on the outer coast. Neese Bay Hatchery, located about 35 miles outside of Ketchikan, is SARA's largest chum facility and their second largest co-producing facility. SARA operates the only ADF&G sportfish hatchery in Southeast Alaska at their Crystal Lake Hatchery, located outside the community of Petersburg. This facility produces chinook and coho salmon under contract to the state to benefit local and regional sport fishing harvest. In addition to the hatchery location, SARA operates multiple remote release sites of chum, chinook, and coho salmon. Located right here in Juneau is Douglas Island Pink and Chum, or DIPEC. DIPEC produces chum, coho, chinook, sockeye, and rainbow trout out of two hatcheries. DIPEC is the only hatchery in Southeast Alaska with a sockeye facility and operates the state-owned Port Snedisham hatchery to the benefit commercial harvest and operates a sockeye lake stocking program as a component of the Transboundary River Agreement of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. Located in the heart of Juneau and Gastineau Channel is McCauley Hatchery. The McCauley Hatchery produces chum, coho, chinook, and rainbow trout. The production of chum salmon allows for sufficient revenue to offset the cost to produce the road system releases of coho and chinook created to increase sport fishing opportunity. DIPEC also partners with ADF&G in a co-op agreement for some of the local road system sport fish releases. These release sites on the road system at Fish Creek, Thane, and Lena Point. In addition, DIPEC has remote release sites for chum at Amalga Harbor, Boat Harbor, and Limestone Inlet. Armstrong Keta is located in Port Armstrong, which is on the southern inside of Baranoff Island. It is the one hatchery in Southeast Alaska with production scale pink production of roughly 100 million. Large contributor of cod to the troll fleet in the Chatham Strait corridor. It is the smallest of the private nonprofits, non-regionals. All right, looking forward to next year. As Ev was mentioned earlier, you know, the best way for us to benefit the fishermen is make sure we make our egg take goals and our cost recovery goals. We don't have the funds to continue to operate. We must increase our cost recovery, which takes fish directly out of fishermen's holds. We must maintain healthy, strong salmon within the hatchery nets and pens to contribute to healthy returns in the future. The best means to success is releasing healthy fish out the door. And then we do support ongoing research with ADFNG, which you'll probably hear from Bill Templin, who's up next, and so they can make science-based management decisions in the best interest of fishermen and other user groups. And just in closing, I want to once again recognize that Alaska Salmon Hatchery Program will be celebrating our 50th anniversary next year. The Alaska Hatchery Program was created to enhance wild production. We continue to see increasing wild production since inception, and to date, the Salmon Enhancement Program has created $5.7 billion of excess value to the commercial salmon harvesters in Alaska. This is value above any operating costs and does not take into account the benefits we have contributed in rehabilitation efforts and direct contribution to sport, personal use, and subsistence salmon fisheries. Well, I hope this information was useful. If anyone would like additional information or to see a hatchery operation in person, please reach out to us or utilize the link on this slide, which will take you to the Salmon Hatcheries for Alaska website, which is a repository of relevant hatchery information. Thank you for your time this morning, and this concludes our presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Wells and Mr. Wagner, for your presentation. Do we have questions from committee members?
Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
And my apologies, I had to step out for another meeting, so if this question got answered, my apologies. Two questions. One is, I'm curious to know what the amount of protein or food substance is being fed to the fry or the smolt or whatever the technical term is, the fish, just before release. I'm trying to understand what are they consuming? How much food are they consuming at the time that they're released? Per pound per day, or, and if this information is not available off the top of your head, then that's fine too. We can get it later, but looking by, per species maybe.
Representative Carpenter, through the chair. So the FDA at the Solomon Gulch Hatchery, I'll speak to pink salmon production, but we conduct a short-term rearing of those fry once they go out of the hatchery and into the sea. They go into net pens. They're fed for approximately 4 to 5 weeks. We feed them a commercial ration manufactured by feed manufacturers in Washington State, Canada. Between the roughly 6 weeks of short-term rearing time, the FDA will feed about 170,000 pounds of feed. So I don't know how that calculates per day. A lot of it varies based on the feed conversion rates, which are subject to weather and water temperature. Fish may feed more heavily, you know, one day and not the next. Some years we'll end up with fish left over. That overall for that 6 week period, that's about what VFDA will feed its pink salmon.
Follow up?
Yeah. So I would like some information on each one of the species that we raise as to how much food they're consuming at the time that we release them. And I can't do that math and don't see that right here. So I'm hoping that we can get some information back that explains how much food is being consumed when we send hatchery fish out into the wild.
For clarification, Representative Carpenter, at the hatcheries, what the hatcheries feed, and then...
Yeah, just before they leave.
Okay.
And if I may, second question.
Follow up, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. Slide 6 talks to the percentage of hatchery fish caught in the sport, personal use, and subsistence. Do we have the similar numbers for how much of the hatchery fish are
Five,
caught
six.
Or a portion of the commercial catch, commercial harvest?
Those numbers are available. We don't have them right in front of us, but we can get them for you.
Any further questions from committee members? Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't necessarily have a question. I just have a comment. And my comment is, if you guys haven't been to a hatchery, it's really, they're really neat to go and see. And I would suggest, and I know that DIPAC is really accommodating and letting, taking us through there. So I would suggest it if you haven't done it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm not missing any questions from committee members. Thank you, Mr. Wells and Mr. Wagner, again for this presentation. And if you would just email the committee the information as you have it, we can disperse it to members. And I imagine that we're going to have a further engagement, a lot more questions from our next presenter around hatcheries and carrying capacity. So thank you so much. We will take a brief at ease as we transition.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Back on the record for our final agenda item today, we will now hear a presentation on hatcheries research by Mr. Bill Templeton, a fisheries scientist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Mr. Templeton is joining us by Microsoft Teams, and the department's ledge liaison, Mr. Joe Feckel, will be moving the slides for us. Thank you. And Mr. Templeton, if you could please state your name for the record, you may begin your presentation. We do have 26 slides, so we have until noon, and I want to ask what you prefer. Is do you want the members to ask questions as you move along, or would you like to complete the slides and then answer questions?
Yes, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Templin, and I'm the Chief Fishery Scientist for Salmon at the Division of Commercial Fisheries in the Department of Fish and Game. I have condensed this slide or this presentation so it's fairly tight and transitions are not obvious, but if you watch the title on the slide, you'll notice when I transition, or else if I remember, I'll stop and indicate that there's an opening for questions.
Thank you so much. And I know that you have condensed a lot of work down to a very short presentation. So I do want to let members know that this is usually a presentation that he takes at least an entire afternoon to do, and is going to, this is a teaser. This is just the little hors d'oeuvre of his work that I wanted to make him available to answer questions and begin this conversation of understanding science. So please continue your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, and good morning to you, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to provide an update, though, on the department's research into the potential effects of salmon hatchery production on natural systems. As indicated, the topics are quite large, and as members of the Board of Fisheries Hatchery Committee can tell you, it can take most of a day, actually, for us to get through just the information on the Alaska Hatchery Research Program. So out of respect for your time and attention, I've condensed both topics, both the pink salmon competition and hatchery research, into about 25 slides. Next. In order to take this 20,000-foot tour through these subjects and not leave anyone behind, I've organized the talk into five sections, each building on the previous section. We'll start with the department's responsibility and mission, followed by an overview of Alaska's hatchery program. I'll take a quick trip through that because you've just received an overview from the previous speakers. This leads us into the large-scale, multi-species, comprehensive research program that was investigating interactions between hatchery and wild salmon in Alaska. We'll follow that with a how we plan to interpret and apply the information to improve management of Alaska salmon resources for the people and communities of Alaska. And I will conclude with an introduction to the department's current approach to investigate salmon abundance and competition at sea. As mentioned, I've removed transition slides, so I'm using titles on each slide as signposts for the progress that we are making. Next slide. As appropriate, I'll start at the beginning. The natural resources of Alaska and the management of their uses for the people of Alaska are fundamental ideas behind our identity as a state. This is so important that they were enshrined in the state's constitution. For example, Article 4, Section 4 stipulates that the replenishable resources should be used, developed, and maintained in a way that allows for sustained yield. Next slide. Based on this constitutional mandate, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's mission statement contains four definitive tasks for management of fish, game, and aquatic plant resources of the state. We must protect, maintain, improve, and manage, all highlighted here in red. It also contains the directive to manage the resources in the best interest of the economy and the well-being of the people of the state in a way that is sustainable. Next. This is essentially a management balancing act, requiring trade-offs between actions that improve the resources and actions that protect those same resources. Next slide. I'll take a quick trip here, cut out a bunch of my information because you've already had an overview. But I want to point out that Alaska's hatchery program can be considered a situation like I just described, a balancing act. As commercial fisheries developed in the early 1900s, harvest steadily increased until the mid-1930s. After that, harvest decreased until about 1950, and then were followed by two more decades of low harvest. This occurrence was a plank in Alaska's platform for statehood. Ore production continued after statehood, reaching new lows in the early 1970s. Shortly after that, three things happened that signaled a new life for Alaska's fisheries. The Magnuson-Stevens Act reduced harvests of salmon by foreign fishing fleets. The ocean became a more productive place for salmon. And the Alaska Hatchery Program began and started a period of increasing contribution to harvests, as indicated by the blue sections of the bars. Next, I'm going to, and next. Basically, this is information that you've received and it's available on the slides. Next slide. If we look at hatchery releases rather than harvest, we see much the same pattern as before. A short initial period of rapidly increasing production, followed by three decades of level or highly increasing or slightly increasing hatchery production. Broken out by species as shown here, it's easy to see that pink salmon and chum salmon account for the greatest portion of juvenile releases. This information is available in the department's annual report on fisheries enhancement. Next, the pattern that you see above is consistent with hatchery production of salmon in other nations in the North Pacific. So you can see there was a period of low production followed by increases and then long, stable decades of production of hatcheries. These data are available in the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission website. This commission is otherwise known as NPAFC. And was established between five nations in order to reduce the interception of salmon from these nations in high seas drift gillnet fisheries. And now it's the organization by which we coordinate enforcement by Coast Guards, as well as research and information sharing. Next slide. This brings us to the instigation for the Hatchery Research Program. The two regions of Alaska with the largest hatchery production of salmon are South Central Alaska, mainly Prince William Sound, and Southeast Alaska. Next. In Prince William Sound, hatcheries have consistently produced and released about 600 to 800 million pink and chum fry since 1988. Production in this region is dominated by pink salmon. Next. In Southeast Alaska, hatcheries released about 500 to 600 million fry until about 2012, when the releases were increased to about 600 to 700 million. In this region, most releases are chum salmon. Next slide. Because of the importance of salmon and the constitutional mandate for sustainability, Alaska's hatchery program was developed under a precautionary approach. Unlike many other hatchery programs, such as mitigation hatcheries, conservation hatcheries, supplementation hatcheries, the intent of our program was to provide fish to be caught. Thus, the program was designed from the start under a structure defined by policies, processes, plans, and permits. The three main elements for monitoring and managing this program are management, fish health, and genetics. This topic is much more completely described in other documents, most recently the ADF&G Special Publication 1812. Next slide. Even with this structured and precautionary system in place, the scale of production in Alaska hatcheries, along with developing assessments of hatchery effects on wild stocks in Canada and the Western United States, raised concern about the potential for similar effects to occur in Alaska. Also, in around 2010 to 2012, Alaska Department of Fish and Game studies in Prince William Sound and Southeast Alaska confirmed the presence of hatchery origin pink and chum salmon in spawning streams across large portions of these regions. Next. This raised the question of whether hatchery fish might have a negative effect on wild stocks in Alaska. Next. There was an increasing compendium of studies in other parts of Western North America, indicating a range of possible interactions and impacts. However, the available studies published at that time were on steelhead trout, Chinook, and coho salmon. Only one study on chum salmon had been published. Next slide. It was going to be difficult to apply this growing knowledge to assess hatchery and wild interactions and their effects on salmon in Alaska. This begins with the fact that the published studies were on different species with different life histories. Pink and chum salmon spend very little time in hatcheries or in fresh water. Other species can spend one or more years in hatcheries or in the fresh waters. Next. If we had more time, I would talk more about each of these, but I want you to see that there's a list of reasons why just grabbing the science from the Pacific Northwest and applying it to Alaska would not be appropriate. It's important to have studies done within an Alaska context. We don't have compromised habitats as they do in the South. We use local stocks. We don't bring in non-local brood stocks. We use large brood stock population sizes to avoid genetic effects. We have very different hatchery objectives. We're trying to provide for harvest rather than for mitigation. And we actually have different hatchery practices. Thus, it was obvious that a comprehensive and different set of research was going to be needed. Next slide. It's historically interesting to note that it was the hatchery operators that approached ADF&G about assembling a panel of scientists and developing the needed plan. Next. The idea was that funding for this research would be provided by the state, by the operators, and the industry. Next. The science panel reviewed the hatchery programs, the existing literature, and available technologies, and settled on three priority questions that would form the foundation for the necessary research and any potential adjustments to the hatchery program. These questions needed to be well-defined, technically possible, and answerable. Next slide. All right, so now I'll get into the results from this very large program. I've condensed it to the major points, and these points are in three separate slides. So I'm going to spend a little time each time describing what you're seeing. The first question that was developed was about the genetic background of population structure, which forms the context within which hatchery-wild interactions occur. This is fundamental as many effects of hatchery-wild interaction will involve genetic introgression, which means moving of genes from hatchery fish into the wild populations. Next. Here I present the population differences using what we call a tree. The length of the path that connects any two populations indicates the genetic difference. Thus, the longer the lines, the greater the genetic difference. We found that population structure exists in both species, but the pink salmon structure is more shallow. There are fewer genetic differences among populations. Next. Even and odd year runs of pink salmon are genetically very distinct, as you can see from this tree. This is not unexpected, since they don't spawn in the same year. Odd year pinks have more differences than even year pinks. This is seen in other parts of the range. Next. Chum salmon have significant genetic differences among populations from different areas. Prince William Sound chum are distinguishable from Southeast Alaska chum, and there are differences among chum populations in Southeast Alaska. Next slide. The second question was about the distribution and variability of straying in the two regions. This was designed in a way that would allow estimation of stray presence in these streams across both districts and regions. Next. Like in other studies, hatchery fish were found in streams mingling with wild salmon. Unlike in other studies, the data here could be combined to estimate the total presence of strays in both districts and regions. Next. What you see here is a plot or a map of Prince William Sound. The blue dots indicate the different region or the different districts in Prince William Sound. Associated with each blue dot is a set of three bars, one bar for each of the 3 years of the study. And then on the bars, you see a blue section and a red section. The blue indicates the proportion of the fish in those streams of that district that are from wild origin and the proportion that were from hatchery origin. For pink salmon in Prince William Sound, the presence of hatchery fish in streams, again the red portions, differed among districts. Generally, strays were concentrated in the southwest corner of the sound. Over the whole sound, annual hatchery proportions range from about 5 to 15% of the total number of spawners. Next. A similar pattern was seen for chum salmon in Prince William Sound. Sound white straying proportions were between 3 and 9%, and most of the straying was located on Montague Island. Next. For chum salmon in Southeast, proportional presence of strays was much more consistent and low across districts. For this region, stray proportions range from 2 to 8%. Next slide. The last question posed was much more difficult, takes longer, and was more costly to answer. Using cutting-edge technology and intensive field sampling, salmon offspring were matched to their parents to estimate the number of offspring produced by hatchery and wild origin spawners. This productivity is a measure of fitness. Next. What you see here is a plot. This is a plot made of smaller plots. Each column indicates an odd year or even year set of samples. Each row of plots is a different stream, so you can compare odd and even by moving left and right at any given row. The yellow or the orange bars indicate females, the blue bars indicate males, and the height of the bar indicates how productive hatchery fish are relative to wild fish in these streams, in these lineages. The dotted line is at 1, which indicates that they're about equal. And in all cases, you can see that hatchery fish are below that line. There's a lot going on here, but here are some takeaway points. Next. Hatchery fish have a lower fitness when spawning in natural streams. Next. There's a lot of variation across generations, streams, and runs, but hatchery origin fish are about half as productive in these streams on average. Next. Not all the results are in. They should be available in 2024. Next. Chum salmon sampling in Southeast Alaska will be complete this year. At this point in time, no analysis has been done. Next slide. This work has been done in an open and credible manner with regular communication in public, regulatory, and scientifically professional contexts. Three papers with early results from the study have been published in peer-reviewed journals. The technical publications, science panel meeting minutes, field reports, and scientific presentations are all available on the State of Alaska website. In addition, the background, processes, results, interpretations, and potential applications have all been presented in public information meetings, at Board of Fisheries Hatchery Committee meetings, and at professional scientific meetings. Next. I know I've been rolling along pretty quickly, and I noticed there have been no questions. Would anyone like to take a quick break for a question?
Any questions from committee members at this time? Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the chair, maybe this is obvious to everyone else, but why, and it's a very basic question, why pink salmon up north and chum salmon in southeast?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot. That is a question probably best answered by the hatchery operators that you heard previously, but one of the most common explanations is that pink and chum salmon have a very short freshwater life history and therefore don't need to be maintained for a year in the hatchery. Likewise, it probably has to do with the fact that Prince William Sound is not as productive for chum salmon naturally as it is for pink salmon. If we look at just total run sizes, and the opposite is true in Southeast Alaska, although the pink salmon runs in Southeast Alaska are large enough to support fisheries, and so the use of hatcheries is not necessary there.
Follow up?
This is another really quick question. The slides aren't numbered, but I don't think we even need to go back to it. But it's possibly an insignificant finding, but when we see the chum, the strays in rivers, it's mainland rivers have higher numbers than island rivers in Southeast Alaska. Is there any significance to that? And it's a sample size of three, right? Three rivers, so.
Through the chair, that's a very good observation. It is a small sample size, although they were chosen to be representative. One of the patterns that we found most consistent and most significant was the proximity of a stream to a hatchery that's releasing chum salmon. So the three streams that you see on the mainland there are near Juneau, and they were chosen for previous observations of strays within those streams, either low or high proportions. So some of the pattern you see has to do with hatchery locations. Some of it has to do with the choice of streams to represent. It would be interesting to look at whether it's mainland or island. And I will make a note of that and add that to our analysis when we start. Thank you.
Mr. Timblin, I have a question on page 13, and it may be answered in your following slides, but when we're looking at the rate of straying, and in Prince William Sound, the pinks are up to 15%. what is the impact on our streams and the wild stocks to that high of a rate of strain?
Madam Chair, another good question. Part of the answer is that what you're seeing is that 15%, 5 to 15% is a weighted average across the whole sound. So you'll see that there are some areas where the proportions are higher. And there are very few strays, mainly on the east side. And then on the southwest side, you'll see that the proportions are much larger. There are several reasons for that. Some of the reasons are salmon tend to enter the sound through the southwest entrances. So the first opportunities for straying are in those areas. Second, the proportion also accounts for the size of the number of fish, the size of the run into that stream. So if it's a small wild run and there are fish present, each of them will proportionally be a larger proportion of the total run to that stream. And the second part of that question is we are beginning to investigate what it means to the management of these fisheries, especially when we base this management on escapement, and we assess escapement as one of our management metrics. What does it mean to have some proportion of the fish that we're counting be from a hatchery rather than being produced in the natural systems? So that is a question that we're working on, and hopefully one of these days soon I can come back and explain what we plan to do.
All right, I have further questions, but I want to let you get to your slides. So I'm not seeing any other questions, so please continue.
All right, so I've taken you about 5 hours through presentations and descriptions. I thank you for the questions because that helps me to know what kind of information you're looking for. We'll start right now about where we left off with that last question on the application of science. Because the application of knowledge is gained from this study is complex. Application will involve more than scientific measurements. Next. As demonstrated, the program is providing scientifically credible and usable information on the interactions between hatchery and wild salmon. This is largely due to careful selection of questions and appropriate design to answer those questions, and the placement of these studies in an Alaska context. Next. However, application of science is complex because more than biology is needed. We also need to consider social, economic, and cultural aspects when we talk about the use of this science. Next. The interface of science and policy is where scientific knowledge is incorporated into belief and value systems to provide a bridge for making decisions. Next slide. To start this piece, then, let's talk about questions that were not addressed by HRP. The research that we did was focused on what is fundamental and could be accomplished, and the application of the results will also be somewhat constrained. However, there are relevant questions that are not answered, such as, next, what is the competition and predation effect of hatchery fish within and across species, within marine and freshwater habitats? Next, do hatchery fish reduce the genetic resilience of wild populations? Next, if changes in productivity are observed, what mechanisms could be driving these differences? Next, how do these hatchery fish in wild systems affect the assessment of escapement, as I just mentioned earlier? And finally, how will findings affect policy? Next slide. In preparation for the time that results are finally available and can be used to inform management, the department continues to develop its assessment of risk. Next. What we know now is that we have the genetic stock structure and background. We have an estimate of wild system productivity. We have a good sense of what the hatchery proportions and distribution of those proportions are in streams. And we have some relative productivity measures in hatchery origin for pink salmon. Next. So what are we working on now? We're still trying to finish this project. We're comparing contemporary and historical population structures before hatcheries and after hatcheries. And we're also developing and gaining more information on productivity. For Prince William Sound, we're about 50% finished. For Southeast Alaska Chum, we're in our final field season, and then the laboratory analyses will begin. Once all HRP results are complete, it'll be a time for interpretation and productivity in context, and we'll time to consider the implications for assessment of escapement. Next. So at this time, we're also continuing to review the literature as the science develops in the Pacific Northwest, Canada, and elsewhere. We'd like to know more about what's happening in other species and other places with genetic resilience, competition, and predation. Next. So our intent is not research for the sake of research, but to use these analyses and their interpretation to inform resource management decisions. Next slide. One model that we are considering is a series of questions that can lead us from through the process of prudential decision-making, wise or appropriate decision-making. Next. These questions organize and transition any discussion of the science and its use through from the purely scientific to the realm of policy and human values. Next. The first question, does an event occur, can be addressed through observation, a scientific exercise. Next. The next two questions, how often and to what extent does the event occur? What does the event have an effect? These can be addressed through scientific measurement and experiment. However, the specific effect that's looked for needs to be defined by the scientist or the end user. Not necessarily obvious from the measurement or the experiment. Next. This next question can be partially addressed by the scientist, but requires some sort of human-derived standard. The term harm needs a definition. Is the effect harmful? That depends on the definition. Next. The last question, would addressing the harm cost more than it would benefit, can only be informed by scientific results. The answer is found through human activities like setting values, definitions, negotiation, and risk assessment. Next slide. My final slides address the topic of pink salmon and competition at sea. Like the section on application of science to management, this discussion is only partly about the nuts and bolts of scientific discovery. The existing scientific discussion or debate about salmon and competition at sea is heavily influenced by the human element. Statements about competition are also statements about cause and effect, generally based on apparent relationships, correlations, between measurement of marine ecosystems and expensive and controlled studies are generally not possible. Next. Here is a very simple example. In this plot, we observe that the sizes of species A and species B, that's the red line and the blue line, change over time, and they kind of match each other. They rise and fall together. This prompts us to think that the change is due to some cause-effect relationship. Next. Yet there are four possible explanations. First, it's just chance. There is no cause. Second, a change in A causes a change in the size of B. Or the opposite, change in B causes a change in the size of A. Or the fourth option is that the changes in size in A and B are caused by something else that we haven't measured. Unfortunately, the correct explanation can't be resolved from the data set alone. Next slide. Establishing a causal relationship requires more work. The best support comes from controlled studies and experiments, just like in agriculture and in medicine. Many variables are controlled for, and the related changes can be attributed to a narrow range of causes. Next. Unfortunately, many biological situations are not amenable to controlled studies, like marine ecosystems. Causal relationships can be acceptably supported using observed associations in the data, but they are not definitive. They require specification of assumptions of cause and effect relationships. They require the scientist to specify his or her assumptions. They also require a higher standard for acceptance. Next. One set of standards has been proposed by Ray Hilborn, Dr. Hilborn, based on the previous work in medicine done by Hill in 1965. The statement is that correlations are strongest when used as evidence when correlation is high, when it's found consistently across multiple situations, when there are no competing explanations, and fourth, the correlation is consistent with mechanistic explanations that can be supported by experiment. Next slide. In the scientific literature on salmon competition, there are four types of relationships that are used to assert competition. Next. First, diet overlap. In other words, they eat the same things. Next. Number two, changes in abundance in opposite directions. When one species increases in abundance, the other species decreases in abundance. Next, similar to that last one, changes this type relies on changes in growth of one species, seeing that it decreases when the abundance of another species increases as an indication of competition. Next, number four, and similar to number three, this type of support or type of observation involves changes in maturity patterns. In other words, fish return younger or they return smaller. And this is all associated with abundance of causing species like pink salmon. Now, there are strengths and weaknesses to these arguments, and they are currently being hotly discussed and debated in scientific circles. Next slide. In fact, this debate is fairly vigorous and can be quite colorful. On the left, we can read that resource vacuum altered community composition left behind as pink salmon migrate. This suggests that they have a destabilizing effect on the ecosystem. But if you move over to the right side, you can read a Russian response, which is, unfortunately, it is difficult to argue and refute fantasies of this kind, and sometimes it's impossible because of their absurdity. You have to respect the Russians for being blunt. Next slide. So the primary arguments made on both sides of the issue can be scientifically valid. For those who are convinced that observed patterns of Pacific salmon abundance have been clearly established and demonstrate competition at sea, this side argues that direct assessment or experimental studies in large marine ecosystems are incredibly difficult, and so indirect evidence is necessary and can be considered sufficient because very small patterns, similar patterns, are consistently found across multiple situations. These perspectives largely focus on interactions only between salmon species. In these perspectives, there's often a focus on pink salmon, with the view that the biannual life cycle of pink salmon provides a natural experiment that can be used for analysis. This perspective largely draws from English written journals and North American research. Next. Those who are not convinced that observed patterns are caused by competition point to the reliance on indirect and correlation as evidence. They point out that studies demonstrating a lack of relationship are often ignored or are not published. In science, we call this confirmation bias, and it is known to exist across all research. They consider the focus only upon competition between salmon species as short-sighted, and it ignores the role of other non-salmon competitors in the marine ecosystem. They point out that while salmon are very important to humans, their importance as predators in the marine ecosystem is relatively small when considering other species with similar diets such as pollock, cod, and herring. They argue that not enough has been done to rule out alternative explanations for the correlations that are observed. For example, biannual patterns are known to occur for important squid species and for some copepod species. There is a disconnect between the kinds of data and perspectives of North American scientists and those of Asian scientists. Both Japan and Russia have long scientific traditions of conducting massive marine surveys to study salmon. In fact, the marine salmon surveys we have in North America are largely all modeled after what the Russians have been doing for decades. Asian scientists more frequently use rich survey data to directly investigate issues of salmon competition at sea and put it in the perspective of the entire ecosystem, while North American scientists more frequently rely on models to indirectly investigate salmon competition because we lack those rich observational data sets. The reliance on very different tools leads scientists to very different perspectives and conclusions. Next slide. The question of competition is not settled, and making changes based on uncertain or preliminary assertions can be harmful to the resource as well as Alaskans and their communities. While the field continues to develop, the scientists and biologists in the department continue to act proactively within the scope of our available resources and in a manner that supports the department's mission. Here's a short list of activities and approaches currently being implemented to advance the science around competition and the marine ecology of salmon. First, our involvement in marine salmon surveys, including Northern Bering Sea and Southeast Alaska, as well as our recent involvement in the International Year of the Salmon surveys. So, related to that is the development of our salmon ocean ecology program led by Dr. Katie Howard, and you'll hear from her on Thursday. This is to collect the information that on Alaska's species and populations that's necessary for us to understand effects on Alaska populations. The next three all involve approaches to dealing with data and or collecting data in a manner that is usable in an Alaska context. The first is confirming the quality of the salmon of the data used for estimating abundance of salmon in the ocean. This relies on NPAFC data, which is all available online, but we just so happen to have Dr. Andrew Monroe is the chair of the working group that produces those data within the NPAFC. And that right now we're working on updating and upgrading the data set that is used in almost all of these studies of salmon abundance. They all use the same data set. Next come Dr. Oxman's work as chair of the marking working group. This job within the NPAFC is to coordinate the marks that are used, the otolith marks and the tags that are used by the different nations so that we can easily find information and identify the production from different nations. That'll give us an idea of distribution, survival, and detection of fish from, say, Russia, Japan, Canada. Finally, coordination of international salmon genetics and genetic baselines and applications. I'm the chair of that stock ID working group. And we're currently working with scientists across the North Pacific to develop genetic baselines that would be used for studies such as the juvenile studies up above I mentioned previously. And this also allows us to look at movements of salmon in the face of warming temperatures. So we've recently been involved in studies documenting the stock origins of pink salmon moving both to the east and west in the Arctic. Likewise, we're keeping up on the science. Next slide. Thank you for your time and attention. Sorry for that very rapid tour. If you don't get a question answered today or I don't answer it completely, feel free to contact me and I'll get you the information you need. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Templin. And I would just like to welcome Representative Kronk, has been here with us for a while as a guest of the committee. Representative Carpenter has questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the Chair. I appreciate the presentation. It's a whole lot of data in a short amount of time and a whole lot of information. I appreciate the dive into how we do the science. I feel compelled to say that while the presentation was very helpful, it appears that we could be studying the problem to death while the fish populations are in crisis. And I don't know what the time frame is for finding a solution through what was just presented to me. I know that on slide 18, it says, what are we working on now? And there's productivity estimates for Prince William Sound pinks, Southeast Alaska chum. And I guess the question that pops into my mind is, if we're working on that now and it's not available for policy decisions now, what data was available last year when we were making policy decisions, or the year prior? What's the data source that we were using in previous years' policy discussions?
Through the chair, that's a very very good question. When I talk about productivity, I was specifically referring to the productivity of natural systems in the presence of hatchery and wild fish in those streams. So it was a more narrow definition of productivity. Our department's assessment of productivity generally is taken into account over long periods of time by multiple brood years and within a system. That's what drives our escapement goal setting and helps us to understand whether we're hitting our targets. So when we talk about productivity on a larger scope, we're generally using harvest information, escapement information, things like that to get a sense of what the productivity is of a system. I apologize for the confusion, and I'll find a way to express that better.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not a scientist. What I want to know is how much food is required for one pink salmon, to survive or thrive at sea? And does the sea have the amount of food necessary for that one salmon to survive? And then I can extrapolate that out into how many salmon are produced, an estimate of how many salmon are out there, and know with just an unscientific policy discussion whether we have enough food to support the amount of fish that we're sending out to sea. And I don't need 10 years of studying. I just need to know, is there enough food in the ocean when we're sending the fish out? Do we have that data?
Through the chair, I'm gonna delay an answer for that because Dr. Howard will address those types of issues in her talk on Thursday. However, I do know that food web, the ecosystem within the North Pacific and Bristol Bay is very complex. Salmon form a small consumer as a whole. All of the salmon that we have out there in the ocean are small consumer type category compared to consumers like pollock and cod, herring, and other species. So it's very difficult to figure out how much an individual fish needs, because any measurement would have to be in context of what the populations of other consumers are. That said, one of the ideas is that you don't have to know an exact number, but you can see a trend. If fish come back earlier, when there are more salmon in the ocean, then, or if they come back smaller, both of those can indicate that the ocean is not as productive for salmon, or maybe not as friendly a place for salmon, and that they are coming home bearing the effects of the struggle for food. Unfortunately, those are very hard to quantify, and but that is why we have the Salmon Ocean Ecology Project to try to address those questions.
Thank you, Mr. Templin, for the presentation. And I have many questions as well. And I know that members of the committee, I think we are seeing the interface between asking the question, and as policymakers, we want to solve problems and know what we can do today to address the issues of our people. And here lies the problem, because your purpose as a scientist is very different from ours. But I am looking forward to just receiving further information. But I thank you for your presentation, and I do encourage members to reach out to the department with further questions. And you can forward those to me. I'm, you know, trying to compile what research the department has done so that we can have that available. But the department's website is full of a lot of really helpful information as well. That concludes our business for today. The House Special Committee on Fisheries will meet again on Thursday, March 16th at 10 a.m. to hear the presentation on the Salmon Ocean Ecology Program by Dr. Katie Howard with the Department of Fish and Game. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It's 11:59 a.m.